This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hong, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, it's been exactly 1 week since last week. Well, it's kind of redundant, but yeah. It's been exactly 1 week since our last show with the coronavirus. So today we are going to be doing the coronavirus part two. There have been a lot of questions, a lot of emails between all three of us. People have been emailing us, so we're just going to go from that for that. How are you guys doing this evening?
Good. Yeah. All is well.
Hold it in. How are you? Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because last week we had the show, and I was a little bit more relieved.
Yeah.
But just, you know, my personality is such that, you know, the HCNC in me was just, I mean, I was having a tough time not staring at the news, just reading every little bit and every little news about California going on lockdown, just put my worst case scenarios in overdrive. And then something interesting happened. Then I read your recent article, Dr. Hawk, and I watched Dr. Lyle's recent video. No, I'm a Star Wars fan, so it was affectionately titled A New Hope. And all of a sudden, my nervous system started to calm down. So I'm still a little bit glued to the news. But this show, let's talk a little bit more about it. So Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, fire when ready. Let's talk about coronavirus.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Jen. We're inundated with coronavirus. What are some of your thoughts? And then I'm happy to spin for a while too, whenever we're ready.
Yeah. Well, we could go lots of different directions with this. I mean, I think a lot of people are having similar experiences to what Nate's talking about, where they're glued to the news, they're in the high alert state, they're just having a really hard time. And you know, I am engaging with this, and I've got pretty much the ideal personality for dealing with a situation like this. I'm fairly introverted. You know, I'm slightly extroverted when I take the test, but I really am quite introverted in practice. I'm just barely over the average line. Very emotionally stable. You know, quite agreeable. The only thing that's really being challenged personality wise by the current situation is openness. But you know, there's that is actually helpful in such a situation, because openness lends itself to some optimism around everything. And so I kind of have been thinking about personality a lot in the context of going through a collective moment and watching how that moment affects different people differently and how they're coping with it, and looking at my own personality and my own agitation and my own, you know, I have a similar experience to some degree that you're describing, where I kind of have my ups and downs with it, where I'll reassure myself with the numbers. And then if I spend a little too much time reading things that are a little too scary and worst case scenarios, it's that is all extremely salient to the Stone Age brain. You know, it's for reasons that I wrote about in the newsletter that you referred to, and we can talk about more, but you know, bad news has more Stone Age significance than good news. And we're completely immersed in this informational matrix, where we are completely surrounded by brand new information all the time, and it's all very scary. And so I think people everywhere on the personality spectrum, even if you're very introverted and very stable, you're having some turbulence associated with this. And it's still uncertain enough in terms of, you know, we can run models and we can look at the data that we have available, and all of that is reasonably reassuring, like we talked about extensively last week, and I think Dr. Lyle and I still believe, looking at the best available data. But it's not a no big deal situation. It's obviously a very big deal, and people are being affected in really direct ways, and lives are being upended, and businesses are being profoundly disrupted, and nobody can really project themselves into the future in any sort of meaningful way to figure out where it is that they themselves are going to stand relative to all of this in the next couple of months. And that's a very destabilizing psychological experience for anybody to have, and particularly if you do have any instability in your nervous system, or if you are more on the extroverted side, or you just have any kind of personality characteristic that makes you more susceptible to the turbulence of the moment. So I have just been telling people, you know, regardless of what their specific situation is, that this is as uncertain as it gets right now. This is, you know, we're sort of in, you know, the absolute heart of trying to figure out what this is going to look like. And in some ways, even if we do descend into worst case scenarioville, which I don't think we will, but even if we do, that brings certainty, and certainty allows us to weave a more finely calibrated cost benefit analysis relative to the problem. And I think what people are really struggling with is just the uncertainty of being able to locate that cost benefit analysis and constantly updating it and constantly running new parameter estimates to secure their position in space and time. And that's exhausting and difficult. And people just need to have a lot of patience and compassion for themselves, just in the heart of this moment, which is not going to last forever.
That's wonderful, Dr. Hawk. Thank you.
Fabulous.
Dr. Lyle, yeah.
Well,
let's see you.
It's unfortunate that this is, you know, this big health scare, and that it's scary, because it's clear to me where my ideal place in the world was. I knew it was in engineering, but now I really know where it was, which was in epidemiology.
Finally found your calling.
There is nothing more really interesting to me than numbers and stats. Well, women are more interesting.
God.
And even then, you rank them in numbers.
Well played, Nathan.
So this is a giant, fascinating math problem, and it's been interesting for me to look at the thinking that comes in from all over the place, and you know, I found some people that I thought are obviously they're exceptionally smart, and that they've thought deeply about the problems, and I've learned, you know, from their analyses, and I sort of percolate that together, and anybody that is that knows a space like this knows that you have to do some equivocating, because you're not sure what the parameters are. And the parameters are numbers keep coming in. And you, as Jen's talking about, your parameters change. And you're trying to get a grip on this because we're talking about a life and death thing. So I guess another place for me to have been would have been in the stock market, which is also an entertaining place these days. But again, numbers, parameters, estimations, mathematical models, this is all quite interesting. And it shows me something that I already knew, which is the extraordinary importance of statistics in trying to understand the world around us. The stats now, some things have, obviously we know more now than we knew a week ago, but we're still under a lot of uncertainty. I think that it's looking like this thing is certainly not the horror that it looked like it might have been, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago. Still, if you look at closed cases worldwide, it's like 15% of the people have died And the World Health Organization is still going to post the amount of cases versus the amount of deaths, and it's still going to look horrendous. It's going to look over 2 or 3%, something like that. I think that there's enough evidence creeping in that is going to indicate that this thing is going to be probably somewhere in the neighborhood of around half a percent, maybe as high as a percent, probably not. But let me explain for people a few problems with the data that we have now. Oh, incidentally, there is something coming that you want to be mentally prepared for. So I'll talk about a variety of sort of mathematical perspectives. One of the perspectives
is... Can I interrupt
is,
you really quickly sure. before you go on the data?
No, I was just getting ready for a role, Nathan. Really? Interrupting me now?
No, go ahead. Just wanted to ask if you could tell us where you're getting this data, because is it the World Health Organization? I mean, when I was at first looking for the data, I would just Google, you know, what's the death rate, but
right.
And I'm assuming some other people do that as well. So where are you getting this data?
There's a website called Worldometer, and that gives mm-hmm. you the fastest changes in the data all over the world. Mm-hmm. So it gives you every country, it breaks it down by country. One of the things I wish that it did, which it doesn't do, is tell us the age of death of the individuals that have died. That would be extremely, I think, reassuring to all kinds of people to see that. You know, we've got evidence apparently from numerous sources that obviously all of the data indicates that people over 80 are, you know, quite a bit more at risk than people that are 70 to 80, and people that are 70 to 80 are at much greater risk than that are people that are 60 to 70, et cetera, and all on down the food chain. By the time you get to people 40 and under, the risk is exceedingly small. 40 to 50, it's very, very small. But it's a tick higher. But people from 50 to 60, it's very low, but it's there. It's on the radar. It's 60 to 70, quite low. When you start hitting 70, the rates start to get, you know, scary, to the point where I think it's probably looking in somewhere in the range of 4%, 3%, 4% of people who are infected if they're in 70 to 80. So that would be, if you think about that, the average age of that population is somewhere around 75. So a little bit less than that, probably, just because that's not a straight bell curve with 75 and then a bell curve around 75. There's more people in the world that live to 70 to 75 than live from 75 to 80. But it's probably 74. So if the average person in that cohort is 74. If they're a non-smoker, their odds might be 3-ish%. If they're a smoker, their odds might be 5 or 6%. So that's what those numbers look like. Overall, in total, the numbers might be around 4, something like that. So that's what that means. So pretty scary thing. But this is going to wind up being from 70 and up, with the average ages. In the 70 to 80 cohort, the average age is going to be late 70s, obviously, if you include all those people. So so probably an average age of, 77. Altogether, those people are experiencing a pretty high rate of risk, 5, 6%, something like that, with smokers disproportionately high in that range. So that's who this virus is overwhelmingly getting. That doesn't mean that nobody else is at no risk, obviously, but that's the lion's share of who's under threat here, which is essentially the same individuals in principle that are under the threat from the flu, which incidentally takes probably somewhere 30, 40, or 50,000 Americans a year, and 600,000 or 700,000 cases a year worldwide. So So to date, I think we have 700 or 800 Americans have died of this. So keep in mind, we've probably had 15 or 20,000 deaths, maybe 10 or 15,000 deaths so far this year from the flu. So far, it's what this is a tremendous threat, and it's going to hit us, but it hasn't really hit us yet. So when you see the numbers in big red letters that show 777 Americans have died, keep in mind what an extraordinary small number that is in against the backdrop of 330 million people. So far, I mean, these are fascinating and important numbers to watch, but statistically, this is being dwarfed by the flu to date by more than a factor of 10. So essentially, we would not be able to detect to date the difference in a flu season if we didn't know the difference between this and the flu, and a flu particularly, that the amount of cases where people were in trouble and dying really wouldn't look any different. It would be a minor blip. It would be a tiny bit, 10% worse flu season. So let's keep in mind that that's where we are right this second. But everybody with a brain understands that that's not where we're going. So where we've been up to now with respect to this has been sort of like if you're whitewater rafting. So if you're whitewater rafting, you know that you're going to hit some rapids and it's going to get scary. And so right now, even though people are terrified, the truth is that the death rates up to now have been really nothing to speak of. That doesn't mean that, hopefully everybody understands what that means. Every one of these things is a sad situation, but statistically, this is nothing. This is now, we've got 330 million people in the country. We've talking about 600 or 700 deaths or so. We're talking about 1 in 500,000 Americans has died of this disease so far. So just keep that in mind. 1 in 500,000. So with the flu being 10 times that much, it's 1 in 50,000. So now what we're going to do is we're going to realize, okay, well, what's the big fuss about if up to now it's 1 in 500,000? And the reason is we've got an infection that we can track a death rate that is, non-trivial. It's multiple times what the flu is. And so as a result, we know we're going to get hit and it's coming, okay? And it's coming here. We're going to learn a lot about what the real parameters look like here in the next 30 days. But one thing is for sure, and that is to prepare yourself for the media onslaught when this goes from, 750 cases very quickly to a couple of thousand cases, very quickly to 5,000 cases, pretty quickly to 10,000 cases, and then to 20. And when you see that, it would be easy to essentially be intimidated and feel like things are completely out of control. But things are not completely out of control. At that point, the coronavirus will have caught the flu, essentially, is what will have happened. The numbers will be similar. And keep something else in mind, that if when you hit 20,000 cases, which I believe will hit in April, that will mean that the corona that will be essentially, now we're talking about a different level of numbers. Now it's, 1 in 16,000 people will have died in this country from that disease. Now remember that 1 in 80 people will die this year, just in general. So essentially this will have added a factor of 1 in 200 to the death rate for the year. So this is now still, even though it seems like a lot of people and it's going to be scary as hell looking at those numbers, it's really still not anything that's out of control. What happens next will be what was important. Okay, so what we don't know, all of the work that everybody's done around this country to try to flatten this curve out, to try to essentially attenuate this process so that maybe we can also get a big boost from what's going to happen, maybe in with summer weather helping out. This thing could calm down and our efforts might really pay off. So we don't know what it's going to look like yet. we also, however, will know probably within 3 or 4 weeks, we'll actually know what the death rate probably is. There is, to the best of my knowledge, there is one place that is the only place that is actually collecting the data that's going to give us the best estimates. There's estimates have come from a couple of different sources that are interesting and important. One of them is the Diamond Princess that had about 700 and some people infected. 10 of those people have now died. I knew that the first eight were 70 and over. The last two, I don't know about. I haven't heard the reports on those. So once again, we are looking at something that in that case now looks like a percent and a half. But remember, the people that are being impacted are all these elderly people. So it's looking like the same 3 or 4% of an age average of 75 or so that we already expected. So there's nothing spectacular happening on that boat that looks different than what you're seeing elsewhere. The other couple of databases that I'm watching, one of them is Germany, because Germany has tested a great many people, and they've been testing a great many people for a while. So what we're watching is we're watching the amount of deaths against the amount of total cases. That was looking like about 0.3 or so a week ago. That now death rate looks more like 0.5. So that's ominous and disturbing. So it looks, but it's still not the greatest data, just because it's not actually systematic testing of the whole population. So it's, but it's getting more and more representative as the numbers of tests and the number of cases gets larger and larger. So it could be that we're converging on something north of 0.5%. Who knows? We're not sure yet. I believe that the best data in the world is going to come out of Iceland. The reason is I believe Iceland is the only place that is actually running essentially random testing. In other words, they're testing everybody. So they're a small enough place and they're an isolated enough place that we may get a really good look at this, because there, as many sources of evidence are indicating, that an awful lot of people are out there that are positive for the virus that have no symptoms at all and never have any symptoms. So we're hoping that this is the case in Germany, and that the German net has not been quite wide enough, and that 0.5 may be the upper limit of what we see, and then it starts to recede when we get larger and larger amounts of people tested. In other words, I think it's somewhat statistically possible that the people that are doing their tests are more likely than the average bear to have the virus, because they may have some symptoms. Even with large amounts of testing, there could easily be a bias in there that could influence the data that we eventually observe. In Iceland right now, it's too early to tell. So we've got about 600 or 700 cases. We have a couple of deaths. So we've got a number of people in critical condition, not a lot, but some. It could easily be enough of those people could die, or the existing other cases could deteriorate, such that we could wind up with something that we don't know what it could look like. Right now, it's not over 0.5. Right now, it's in the beneath there. But it's too early to tell. So given that the U.S. rate, again, the U.S. has not been a big tester. So a great number of the U.S. tests have gone to people who are ill or have symptoms. The U.S. rate is currently about 1.2%. It's been dropping. I've been watching those numbers drop. Again, non-representative samples. It's hard to tell what it looks like. But here's what it doesn't look like. It doesn't look like the 2-3% that would have been, you know, and would be an incredible calamity. So 2-3% would put, you know, in the U.S. population, would put 7 or 8 million people at risk. That would be a staggering wave. We still have the possibility that that's how many people would be at risk if the virus was so virulent that it not only killed that number of people, but it was also super communicable and everybody got the virus, which is unlikely. Most epidemiologists I've listened to don't think that that's a remote possibility. So when we start looking at things like the flu, We're starting to look at things that might have, you could have 50, 60 million cases in the United States of this thing, potentially. If you did, and you have, you know, 0.5%, then 0.5% would be 300,000 cases that would add, you know, and we know who they would be. So we know that this is going to be heavily loaded in our elderly population. Remember that so now I want to do something else. So now that we sort of looked at these numbers and we're preparing ourselves for the whitewater that you're about to get in April. So it's coming. You're going to get some scary news, going to have some big numbers up there. And when you see 20, 25,000 Americans have died of this and hospitals are you know, working overtime, remember that this is not actually unexpected, that this is the fear and the reasons why we have done all the things that we've done. And we're still, you know, 20,000 people, remember, is an exceedingly small number of people. It's 1 in 16,000. And remember, 1 in 80 of people will die this year. Okay, so that's so we are, that 1 in 16,000th of those people is plucking off some of the 1 out of 80 that were headed that direction this year, certainly. So what does this all mean when we get away from the big numbers and the scary news shows? And let's back up and try to figure out what it means for us. A thing that I read in the last few days was a calm, reassuring, intelligent report of a Nobel Prize winning chemist at Stanford University. I don't know his name. Jen may have written it down. Did you write his name down somewhere?
I did. Give me just a second here. Michael Levitt. Is in the LA Times. Yeah. We posted links just for people who are listening. There's a keeping a sort of collection of useful links for articles that we talk about that I have linked from my Instagram page and also from my Facebook page, but I can send it to Nate so he can post it on the Beat Your Genes page as well. It's just a little link tree list of articles and resources and things that we've been referencing and that we would recommend. And that article is a LA Times article that Doug is talking about, and it's on that list.
Yeah. So this character, obviously plenty of brains. It's almost artistically ridiculous because apparently what he did was he looked at the math in February, and his report was published, I guess, in the major China newspaper, that based on early data, he said, you're going to have 80,000 infections and about 3,250 people are going to die by X such a date. When that date came, there was about 80,300 cases or something like this, and there was 3,245 deaths. So he was only within five. Okay. So when I hear something like this that wasn't done post hoc, in fact, it was published early, and the guy said this is what's going to happen, and then that's exactly what happened, you get my attention. So his analysis of the situation is, look, this is going to be unpleasant. A lot of people are going to die of this, but here's the way to think about it when it comes to you, because that's really, in the end, it's about the people that are important to you, and it's about yourself. It's like, what does this mean for me? This was his way of calculating the numbers for your personal risk. I thought it was very interesting. What he said is, I think I'm getting this right, Jen, so you correct me, if you get the virus, your personal risk of death doubled for the next 2 months what it otherwise was going to be.
Mm-hmm. That's what he said, yeah.
Okay, so in other words, if you are 45 years old and healthy, your risk of dying in the next 60 days is infinitesimally small.
But just to insert that's it's double the risk. That sounds very scary in the way that those relative numbers always sound scary without people who have a sense of what that absolute data is. Your risk of dying in the next month is very, very, very low if you're in that low risk group. So double almost zero is still almost zero. So that's what people miss when they hear that sort of phrase, like, oh my God, it doubles my risk of dying. And that does sound very scary and taps into like a lot of adrenaline. But when you actually, like, what does that mean for you? It does not mean that you were that meaningfully more statistically likely to be taken out by this thing. So that's just very important for people to understand.
Right.
It sounds awfully familiar. With a lecture I heard either you or Dr. Goldhammer or somebody in the plant-based world say, and they looked at a study of cholesterol advertisements, cholesterol medication advertisements, where they say it will lower your cholesterol by 50%, and ended up going from 3 to 2.
Yeah, this is relative and absolute differences, and it's a huge, the big marketing trick and very confusing to people.
Right, but this is really an interesting way to look at it. So let's suppose you are 75 years old, and let's suppose you're in not very good health. And so if we did a Northwestern Mutual Life, we had a doctor come and take every parameter on you, and they would say, you know what, you're probably not going to make it more than 3 years based on all these numbers. And so you're kind of in the bottom end of the curve of 75-year-olds, because the average 75-year-old probably has, 7 or 8 year life expectancy. So we'd have to look that up on a table, but that's probably the case. So let's suppose you're an average 75-year-old. If we looked this up on a Social Security database table, we would find that the average 75-year-old probably has, let's guess that it's 8 years. It's not a bad guess. So all other things being equal, we're just taking somebody smack in the middle of the bell curve, not doing anything particularly stupid, not doing anything smart. This is just got 50 percentile written on their forehead. So that means they're expected to live 100 months, basically. So their odds of dying in the next month are very small. So let's suppose that, that's actually, so if their life expectancy is 8 years, they could live 12, but they could live 4. They could live 16, but they could live none. So as a result, the average is 8 years. So in principle, we would look at this and say, okay, well, there's about 100 months to go of this life, and then the person's going to pass away. So there's, we're going to call this a percent a month. So there's sort of one chance in 100. That you're going to pass away. But now you caught the coronavirus. So in the next month, the next 2 months, your odds of dying would have been 2% collectively, adding 1 and 1. But now instead it's going to be 4. Okay? So that's what it's going to be. So that's what this epidemiologist or chemist was trying to explain. So this is why the numbers look the way they do. Remember, not a lot of 55-year-olds die, just up and die in the next 2 months. Not a lot of 46-year-olds up and die in the next 2 months. It's just not how it works. But a lot of 77-year-olds up and die in the next 2 months. In fact, 1 or 2% of them, okay, in the next 2 months. 4, 5, 7, 8, 12% of them will die this next year. Okay, so at 5 or 10% a year, in the next collectively over the next 10 years, they're very likely. If you're 77, your life expectancy is probably 6, 7, 8 years. Okay, so your chances of dying any individual month as you get into your later years is like 1%. Like this, that's what you're staring at. Now, there's a 99% chance you're going to survive the next month, but there's a 1% chance you won't. Now, I want you to think about the people that are very ill. So you're not an average 77-year-old, you're a sick one. So what are your odds? Well, your odds are that you might only reasonably expected to live the next 4 years. Okay, so you're not in as good a shape as your brother Harry, who took care of himself. So now you've got about 50 months left, not 100. So as a result, your odds are 2% a month. So over the next 2 months, your odds are about 4%. Whereas if you catch the coronavirus, it's 8%. There's the big hit. So this is exactly the kind of numbers that we're seeing from the coronavirus. That's why it's loaded the way it is. If you're 62, your odds of dying in the next month are not 1%. They're probably 0.2%. Okay, so over the next 2 months, it's probably 0.4%. And so if you get the coronavirus, it's probably 0.8%. And that's the kind of numbers that we're going to see. So from your standpoint, from anybody that's listening, the way to gauge this, I had a friend of mine who is really upset and worried about her daughter who was taking her granddaughter into a store. And she's all upset about this and just loves that grandchild so much. And grandchild's about a six-year-old girl. And I said, the odds are effectively zero. That I don't know that there's been a case in the world of a person under 10. I don't think there has been. So the is it possible, and are we going to get one? Well, if this virus worldwide manages to match the flu and has it, you know, and 650,000 people die of this virus, including 30,000 or 40,000 Americans, if it matches the flu this year, then undoubtedly, we will see a few cases of very young people. But statistically, this is exceedingly small. They're more likely to die in an auto accident. So this is what we're looking at. The numbers are going to get ominous. But curiously enough, you know, when we're looking at the impact on you, and this thing goes to 20,000 in the next month, remember, it's 1 in 16,000 people. It's nobody that you know. It may be somebody you've heard of or a celebrity or something like that. But 16,000 people? I don't know 16,000 people. So the odds of this hitting close to home are very low. And so our job is what it always is, as it would be with the flu. If you were sick with the flu, you know, don't go visit your grandmother. Be careful. Be respectful. Be responsible. The new term of life is social distancing, which, you know, I didn't know what they were going to call it. That's kind of creative and intelligent. Now we all know what that means. And so, you know, we're smart about this. Hopefully we flatten the curve. The big thing that we were after here, I think that we're going to achieve to some degree of success, is not that we're going to blunt and stop this thing from taking a lot of lives early. In other words, a few months early, maybe a year or two early in some cases. but what we're going to be able to do is hopefully, through all of this collective action, make it so that we don't have unnecessary deaths that human beings could have prevented by more optimal use of our medical facilities. So that's what we're trying to do. And now we brace for the whitewater because we're going to get it.
Absolutely fascinating. And this brings me to another question for you, Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk, because Dr. Hawk just recently wrote an article called When Bad News is Good News.
Yes.
And so, I mean, the general question is what's up with
brilliant,
this extreme
by the way. I'll tell you what, I am rarely just absolutely envious of somebody else's writing. So I've had that experience at times, like Harry Potter. I just got to tell you, the woman's a freaking genius. Okay, so it's just the way it is. And Carl Sagan could tell a story, and Richard Dawkins in his prime, you know, and some of the things that he's done has been incredible. But when Jen Hawk scribbled that thing out, I heard when she started it, and it wasn't long later that she was done. Believe me, it was like, oh, I'll get back to you in about half an hour, Doug. I'm working on something. Tremendous, Jen. Just a work of art. Yeah, go ahead, Nathan. Now you can talk.
Thank you. Thanks. I'll hit the ego trap alarm over here.
Yeah. Well, you already finished it, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is. Yes, I already finished it. Yeah, it's Yeah.
We're putting the bar. Yeah, we can't help
your next one. Better be much better.
That's right.
Yeah, go ahead, Nathan.
No, it's just an excellent article. I really can't say more than you already did, Dr. Lyle, about it. But the question I have is about this extreme polarization. Like I got some nasty emails, and I've seen nasty comments on Facebook, on the social media sites. Mm-hmm. Got some emails, you know, after the podcast last week. People are, I suspect they were misinterpreting what you were saying or hearing what they wanted to hear out of it, whatever it is. But I haven't seen it this bad since people started talking politics. You know,
This is sort of Jen's. This is your arena. Hey, you wrote it.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I think Nate's talking about sort of polarization just generally, not necessarily about, you know, anything that I was saying or that you were saying last week. But it's I have been quite astounded by how politicized it has become and how quickly. And you know, I talk about in that article, and if people want to read it again, I'll send that to Nate so you can put it on the Beat Your Jeans page. It's also posted on my website at jenhawk.com if people want to find it. I was talking about essentially the Stone Age incentives that we have to bring new information to the village. So there weren't a lot of ways in the Stone Age to improve your lot in life. You were born into a caste system that revolved around looks and ability. It's very much like high school. And so you were kind of stuck with the social standing that you had. But one of the best ways to improve your position, and we've talked about many, many different examples of this on various podcasts and elsewhere, was to bring some useful knowledge to the village that improved everybody's chances of survival and gene survival. And that could come in the form of good news, and it often did. So, hey, I discovered a better way to build a mousetrap. I discovered a new food that we a new place, a new hunting ground. I discovered something very positive. I learned from somebody that I met in another village, and I'm bringing that back to you. But it also very often came in the form of essentially bad news. And bad news could be an early warning. You know, I was over the hill and I saw the advancing barbarians, and we better get out of here. And so people who were bearing bad news, you know, there was a chance of a vastly increased social status that accompanied that. And so we have a built-in little Stone Age circuit that kind of gets us excited about bad news. And then you insert that circuit into a world of social media, and everybody has their own little soapbox that they can get up on. And we know that people, once they make essentially a public declaration of an opinion or you know, any kind of assertion in the public sphere on their Twitter feed or on Facebook, once they've committed to it, the costs of reversing that position increase massively. You were very disinclined to correct yourself later on once you've committed to a stand on something like that. So that's part of why people just tend toward polarized debates about everything in general, is everybody has their own little megaphone, and they've committed to their position, and they're risking a major, major status hit to reverse position. The correct thing to do from an evolutionary perspective is to double down on what you have stood behind. And if you're asserting the worst and you're the bearer of bad news, and you're out there posting the data that says that this is going to be a total catastrophe and all of our systems are going to collapse, you've put yourself in a situation where you have an evolutionary logic that is driving you to commit to that and double down on it and essentially hope for the worst case scenario. And it's a really difficult place to be. And you're captive to strong Stone Age algorithms that are driving that kind of incentive, because the potential payoff is so high if you turn out to be right, because you brought this information to the village. You tried to warn the fools. That there's a lot more status associated with that than, oh, hey, my bad, I guess I overreacted. Whoops. Like that's not going to be a good look for you in the Stone Age. So the polarization around it and the degree to which people have really dug in and are becoming at, like catastrophizing advocates. I think there are very good evolutionary reasons for that. But it has led to a real deterioration of conversation about this. And it's one of the reasons that I have had to really make sure that I follow my own advice and stay off of social media for the most part, and really carefully choose my sources carefully. So, you know, the article we're talking about from the Nobel laureate, that guy is a, you know, he won that prize for complex chemical modeling. He's a biophysicist. This guy is a useful source of information about this problem. Where, you know, my cousins on my Facebook feed are not exactly the greatest resource. And so you just have to be discerning, be careful, control your environment. Just like we're always talking about controlling your environment is absolutely, you know, defining your life experience, whether that's who you're spending time with, which you may or may not have as much control over given the current quarantine situation. But it's also your information environment and what kinds of resources and information you're exposing yourself to on a regular basis. And it's especially when you are predisposed to hear things like relative risk and these big numbers that are being thrown around and the overrepresentation of outlier cases that are just going to lend themselves to splashy headlines on social media and elsewhere, like, oh, another 39-year-old healthy person is, you know, falls ill and is dead within a week from this thing. It's very, very scary, very overrepresented, because if it bleeds, it leads. That's the story that you're going to see. You're not going to see the story about the 75-year-old with complications from diabetes who was very likely to die this year or next year, as Doug is pointing out. Those stories do not make headlines. You are being exposed to a non-representative environment of information if you're not careful. So those are a lot of the pitfalls that people will get into around this.
Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, why I really appreciated Dr. Lau, your video, when you basically said that it is the right move to overreact until you know more, because not overreacting could cost you your life, and, you know, in the Stone Age. And mm-hmm. so now that we know, as more data becomes available, then we should shift our behavior mm-hmm. as we know more and more about this. So that actually gave me a sigh of relief that. Because. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it allowed me that, okay, I can give up the status that maybe I had been holding on to, because, you know, all of a sudden now, yeah, that was the right move, may no longer be the right move when we have more data. So,
yeah, I don't know if people are aware of this, but it's an election year. And so there's some context with that as well. And there are, you know, we've talked about what we call perverse incentives in the political science world on the show before. And the, you know, sort of there are perverse incentives to, be seeking news that is disturbing to keep things somewhat uncertain and advance political agendas on both sides of the table. So there's a lot of leveraging of a moment like this that's going to be it's politically irresistible. So anybody who is in the business of politics is going to be at some level excited about a crisis, because it provides a lot of opportunities to rally the troops and to, you know, pursue other agendas and to do a lot of different things. There's a lot of great political science written about this kind of phenomenon, and you're seeing both parties doing it to some significant degree, and it's getting amplified in the months leading up to a very important election. And I think we can just expect a lot more of that, and sort of competing agendas for how to interpret the information as it develops, particularly as it remains, as it has any uncertainty with it at all, which it currently does.
Mm-hmm. Now, so the next question I have then is about the economic impact, and then the more personal economic impact. So obviously, you know, the economy has been going down quite a bit for a couple of weeks, more so than we've ever seen, or at least I've ever seen in my lifetime. And you know, I have faith in the system that it will recover. But in the short term, what advice do you have for maybe people who are either getting laid off, or businesses who may be struggling, or anything in that realm, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk?
You want to tackle that one? Oh yeah, it's a good question. I mean, this is a There's so many different perspectives because people's situations are also different. This is where we learn, you know, if you go through a tough time here, then it will be an important lesson. The great basketball coach John Wooden, who is so full of little concepts that he would distill into sayings to try to teach his young men really about life. And one of them was a saying that says, when you lose, don't lose the lesson. And that's what I would say here, that the lesson is be prepared. Any sort of financial advisor, analyst, anybody that thinks about any of these issues knows that you should reasonably be able to handle 6 months of serious trouble. That's why you have insurance. That's why you have savings. You don't know that you're not going to be in some nasty auto accident and laid up and not being able to work. And then you're going to have some degree of unemployment and you're going to have some stop gaps. But, you know, careful of your overhead relative to your ability to be resilient to some unforeseen circumstances. So the and if it turns out this what happens here in the next 60, 90, 120 days, which I don't think it's going to be an economic calamity for that long, but it could be. If it is, and you know there are serious problems that you have to struggle with, which there will probably be inconveniences. There probably will be nothing quote serious. In other words, you may be inconvenienced. Your savings may go down. You may have to increase your debt, you know, et cetera. You may have to apply 3 times for unemployment because the government's slow getting it to you. We don't know what the problems are. You might have to move in with your mother and get a foreclosure, but I just understood that, you know, the law is stepping in and stopping that kind of thing from happening. So, however, if you are kind of seriously inconvenienced and it's unpleasant and it's embarrassing and it's uncomfortable, let's keep it in perspective. You're probably not going to be cold. You're not going to be hungry. And your life isn't going to be threatened. You're going to be inconvenienced and you're going to have a financial setback. If that's uncomfortable and results in a lot of dislocation of your life, which it could, if that's true, then it's going to be frustrating and bitter and disappointing and all sorts of things. But if when you lose, don't lose the lesson. And that means, okay, next time I won't play quite so close to the edge. I will be a little bit more conservative with my behavior, and I will be better prepared for trouble. And always, you know, that's why we have insurance for various things. But when it comes to sort of short and intermediate term calamities that could impact your life significantly, that's why the best insurance that you can have is to have some money saved in the bank and to have an overhead that, you know, that you can cover for a period of time of trouble. So that's what I would tell you. And if it turns a little bitter and you got to sell your Mercedes or let them repossess it, that's okay. We can get past all of that because in the end, what really is going to count is your health. As long as you get this thing through this thing and you're healthy, which the overwhelming majority of people will. Okay, so let's just revisit the numbers for 1 second. So let's suppose that you are an elderly person, and let's suppose that you are at high risk. What are we really looking at? If you're in your 70-somethings, late 70s, your odds may be 4 out of 100 if you get the virus that you don't make it. But the odds of the virus visiting you are probably no better than 1 out of 10. They might be higher, but they're probably not. So that means that that's about 4 out of 1,000. So probably 4 out of 1,000 77-year-olds will face this problem. That means 996 out of 1,000 won't. So let's keep in mind, this is not a tidal wave, although the numbers can look like it. It's a threat. It could touch your life directly, but most likely the most likely way that it touches your life is going to be you know, in your pocketbook and being inconvenienced. So hopefully most of us will be fine. We'll be slightly annoyed and bitter and uncomfortable about some that our balance sheet isn't as good as it was planning to be by the summer. But that is not a problem. That's what I call BS problems. Those aren't real problems. And most of the problems that will come out of this are inconveniences, not tragedies. So, but we can always learn the lesson if we need to. And if we have to go through this and it gets uncomfortable, then it does. But we'll be better prepared next time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading that worldometers.info a couple of days ago. Yep. And it's interesting that SARS, the severe acute respiratory syndrome, had a death rate of almost 10%.
Yeah.
And the MERS, which is the Middle East respiratory syndrome, was like over 30%.
Wow.
Yes.
And yet I don't remember such a crisis occurring.
Well, there was a few thousand people that died.
Yeah, it was smaller. Okay. Yeah, smaller numbers, and also, I mean, don't underestimate the rapidity with which the information has spread with social media. Like, I know I'm harping on that, but certainly for SARS, little different for the Middle Eastern respiratory, but the SARS crisis, that was, I don't remember what year that was, but it was maybe 2002, 2004, somewhere in that neighborhood. And it was, you know, we were not living in the kind of constant information overload kind of state that we are now, where people could share information and information could spread as quickly as it does. And as could misinformation and exaggerated numbers and, you know, the sort of overrepresentation of outliers, all of these things are contributing to a little increased level of hysteria. I'd also just add to what Doug was saying about don't lose the lesson, that, you know, I really appreciate that a lot of people are not, you know, don't have savings. You know, a huge percentage of people have less than $1,000 in savings or no savings at all, and are just completely vulnerable to this kind of situation, and you know, have gotten in that situation because of a lot of different interacting life circumstances. So it's don't lose the lesson, not just in the sense that, oh, well, you should have more money in the bank, because, you know, of course you should have more money in the bank, and it doesn't always seem possible to do so. But that's, you know, that's a lot of what we're talking about the difficult decisions that you have to make, you know, downstream with how you're designing your life and the kind of environment that you're creating for yourself, has a lot to do with your ability to set up that kind of safety net for a moment like this. So people will get in these situations of financial dependence on other people that will essentially bypass the process of creating your own safety net, you know, whether it's a marriage or whether it's dependence on parents or dependence on adult children or any number of different types of enmeshment that people get themselves into, and they get complacent and you know, don't kind of defend their own experience against the worst case scenario. So that's one way that this can happen. Another is that people will be in a job where they're not making very much money and they're not able to save as much money as they would like because of a personality distortion of agreeableness or conscientiousness or all kinds of different things. I mean, there are just a million different scenarios that are going to contribute to environmental choices that make protecting yourself against this kind of situation more difficult. So, you know, when we're talking about don't lose the lesson, it's encompassing all of that. It's encompassing the way that you're designing your life and making these choices and who you're spending your time with, all of those things are contributing to the overall context that makes you more or less resilient to any kind of crisis, including a public health one like this one.
Yes.
Dr. Hawks, are you suggesting that we design our life to have friends and potential mates as people that we can see ourselves being quarantined with?
Yeah. Well, ideally, yeah. I mean, it's kind of like a little snap test of, you know, if you're stuck with these people for an indeterminate amount of time and you hate them, you know, it's if you're in a relationship that you haven't been happy with and now you find yourself locked in with that person and surviving this experience with them and it's bringing all of these issues to a head. I mean, I've been talking to
and
a lot
all the
of
liquor
people.
Stores are closed.
Yeah, I've been talking to a lot of people who are having, you know, some version of that experience, and that's another, like, you know, the universe is telling you something. It's telling you that this was never the right relationship, and we just had to really escalate the circumstances to make that abundantly clear. So yeah, don't forget that when we get back to normal life. And it is, you know, we'll use the word inconvenience a lot to sort of describe your willingness to pay, your willingness to be uncomfortable, to make big changes in your life, because you can always make the changes. You can always quit the job. You can always quit the relationship. You can always break the contract. But it often brings with it an estimated level of discomfort and dislocation and inconvenience that you were not willing to pay. And so this kind of moment, it's a pop quiz about, well, how are you sure you're not willing to pay it? You know, and how much are you willing to pay? And you might discover that those parameters are not what you thought they were once you're really stuck with somebody, or stuck in a situation, or stuck confronting a level of financial insecurity that you weren't prepared for. So all of these things are opportunities to really reflect on the choices you've been making and how you can hopefully move forward with a little more, you know, little more attention to these kinds of things going forward.
Yeah. I have just a couple little rules of thumb that are kind of just worth passing through people's minds. And that is that there are $100 problems that come up all the time. You get $100 surprises. $1,000 surprises are rarer. They're significantly rarer, but they happen. $10,000 surprises are very rare. Unless if you're a high income person and you're doing a bunch of business, then $10,000 surprises are common. But I mean, relative to a person's ability to survive and be reasonably comfortable, $10,000 unpleasant surprises are not common. So it would make sense to be looking to try to get ourselves first to $1,000 saved to essentially buffer ourselves from fairly intermediate level unpleasant surprises. We get to $5,000 saved. Now we've buffered ourselves against quite a few problems, a high percentage of them. You get to $10,000 saves. You've buffered yourself against a lot of life's unpleasant vicissitudes. And so that's a kind of thing where, you know, with, you know, young people, I'll say, listen, you know, we should be in a position where if, you know, something bad happens, you've got a way to reach out and put your hands on that kind of level of income. Or that level of money. Maybe your mom has it and it's not a problem at all. Maybe you've got it somewhere already salted away. That's fantastic. Maybe you have good credit and you have a credit line and you could do it. But by some method, it's essentially what you want is a buffer zone between you and trouble. And now, you know, right now the government knows that this is a problem for millions of people right now. And so they're trying to come in and basically be that, you know, essentially be that buffer zone. And so they're going to do what they can. But mostly what we want to do is be prepared ourselves. So that's about all I have to say about it.
Absolutely wonderful. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, thank you so much for settling my nervous system down over this last week through your continued resolve for finding the truth and spreading the truth. I really appreciate that. And we'll look forward to, you know, we may have a few more questions next week if this thing continues, but hopefully we'll get back to the normal format with relationship questions, who we want to be quarantined with, et cetera.
Sounds good.
Or not.
Yes. All right, Nathan, thank you very much.
Yeah, have a great night.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.